This is a talk from BeThinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit BeThinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to hear all about BeThinking.org's latest releases. I feel light in your arms. This lecture is the third in my series on tearing down the walls, communicating the gospel today. And this lecture is going to be a little bit different from the other two. In the other two, I've been primarily speaking about the barriers that we have, as Christians have raised between ourselves and unbelievers, and the difficulties of communication that result from that. But this afternoon, what I want to address is the barriers that are raised in the culture, or at least some of them, and to suggest some ways forward for us, if we are Christians, to communicate to people who are shaped by these ideas I'm going to speak about, whose lives are governed by these things. You remember I mentioned four barriers in my first lecture raised by the culture: cynicism, uncertainty about any kind of meaning at all in life, relativism, a loss of moral certainty, and certainty and truth being purely personal, and moral values being personal. Thirdly, secularism, the attempt to find complete satisfaction and meaning in the present, in life here and now, in this gap between birth and death. And fourth, the kind of idols that people worship: work and sex and money and pleasure and so on. Now, it's those barriers, those patterns of thought and behavior that I want to address this afternoon. Now, I know some of you here are not Christians, and perhaps some of you are touched, in fact, I'm sure you are, by one or another, if not all, of these things. And some of you who are Christians are touched by them too. It's very difficult for many of us to avoid cynicism living at this moment in history. It's very difficult for us not to be touched by moral relativism and to feel that we have a right to say, I know what's right for me, what I should do with my life. It's difficult for all of us not to be touched by the tremendous pressure of our culture to consume more and more and to find our satisfaction entirely now. And it's difficult for our hearts not to be led astray by the idols of our time, material things and pleasure, the self, money, sex, work, and so on. Now, I want to address these four areas, or whatever we want to call them, one by one, and say a little bit about each of them in terms of how we can go about communicating to people. So today we're going to have a little more apologetics rather than anything else, we might say. So let's start with cynicism. Cynicism. You remember I told the story of how just before I left St. Louis 2 weeks ago, I had a game of tennis with somebody in St. Louis. And he informed me proudly after our game of tennis that he was a cynic. That I had chosen the easy path by being a Christian, that it was very easy to believe in God, and because basically being a Christian gave you a completely man-centered universe. He obviously didn't understand much about Christianity, to say that. Though perhaps he could be forgiven for saying that as we look at much that goes on in the church, which is very man-centered. But he said, you've taken the easy option, and I've chosen the hard road. I've come face to face with this kind of grim reality that nothing really means anything ultimately. That all that is left for us is basically cynicism. that the world we're living in is a world which is ultimately meaningless. After we die, there's not going to be anything. We haven't come from anywhere or from anybody. That the world is ultimately purely material. So there can be no real significance to a human life, no ultimate or final meaning. And he went on discoursing about this. And particularly, he kept quoting H.L. Mencken at me, who was obviously his guru, I suppose, because he had a first edition of everything he'd ever written, and he'd obviously read them from cover to cover over and over again. Now, you remember Wim speaking about postmodernism and saying that it's really nihilism with a smile. Well, in a way, that's where many cynics are. Nihilism with a smile. An attempt to simply joke about the fact that life is ultimately empty and absurd. Really futile. And yet, to maintain a little smile about that. Now, how are we going to reach such a person? Well, let me tell you what I said to him. I said to him, Joe, you know, that sounds very good, and it sounds very brave. A really hard road to walk along. But I want to suggest to you that you have kept a sacred corner in your life. An area of your life which you haven't allowed cynicism to touch, where you preserve meaning and value, where there are things that you really hold on to as precious, which you don't joke about. And that's what's really at the heart of who you are, not the cynicism. And I said, I've just met you this afternoon, but let me guess that in your case, it's your marriage and your family. He's a man who's retired and obviously has now grandchildren. And I hit the nail right on the head, in the right spot, as Wim would say. I got the nail on the right spot. Now, you will find that this is generally true of people who are cynics. In fact, I would say always true. Unless a person has reached a point of total despair. That they will keep some, what I call their a sacred corner in their life, a place which is safe, a haven from their cynicism, a haven from their jokes, something that really matters to them. Now in Romans chapter 1, when Paul is talking about the unbeliever, he says, the unbeliever holds down the truth or suppresses the truth in unrighteousness. And the image there that you have is as if inside an individual, they are kind of trying to push God's truth down. And it's always sort of escaping through their fingers back up into their consciousness and into their heart and into their imagination. But the unbeliever is suppressing, holding down the truth in unrighteousness. Now, it's that we need to point out to the cynic. The things which he holds precious, the sacred corner in his or her life, is in fact, of course, a good gift of God. Something which is indeed a part of the wonderful reality that God has made and given to us. As Paul says, in Acts 14:17, when he's speaking to this group of pagans, he says, you know, God gives us rain and the crops in their season, and he gives joy to our hearts as well as food to eat. God is the giver of every good gift. And what the cynic is doing is holding on to one of those gifts of God and building his life around them, and at the same time insisting that life is meaningless and not letting it touch. That meaninglessness touch that particular area. It's that we have to point out to the individual, to point out the radical inconsistency, if you like, at the heart of what is most precious to this person. Schaefer used to use the expression, get him to ride his tiger. The cynic's tiger is his view that reality is ultimately absurd. Tell him, what would happen to your family? What would happen to your marriage if you rode your tiger? What would happen to this sacred corner of your life, this gift of God, which you carry on treasuring, and rightly so, but fail to acknowledge the giver of that gift? So you challenge the cynic, if you like, to ride his tiger, and you point out to him his sacred corner. Now you will find many people, all of you will find many people at times in your life who are in this kind of position. It was the sort of position I was in before I was converted. At university, feeling life was completely meaningless, that there really were no answers to be found at all, that the questions I was struggling with, is there an ultimate difference between good and evil? Is there any value to a human being or to a human life? That there were no answers to these questions at all. And for myself, like many people who get caught in this kind of pessimism, this kind of cynicism, it led me to the very edge of suicide. In fact, I went out one day to actually kill myself by throwing myself over a cliff near Manchester where I was at university. There's a famous cliff outside Manchester called Alderley Edge. And I went out there one day in January just to say, well, this is it. I'm going over. When I got there, Alderley Edge is a famous beauty spot in that part of England. And even there in the depths of winter, at the very heart of winter, it was a place of extraordinary beauty. And it was that tremendous sense of the glory, the beauty that is there in creation that prevented me from taking that final footstep over the edge. Because I was being confronted, if you like, just as every cynic is, with something in life which is indeed really precious. Confronted with some aspect of the glory of God's creation, the glory of the life that He has given us. Yes, there is a great deal of pain. There is a great deal of sorrow, but there are also many very beautiful and precious things which surround our lives. I certainly didn't know God at that time. I didn't believe in a creator. But it was that overwhelming sense of the order, the beauty, the glory of creation, which held me back from that step, and which a little time later, God led me to a Christian I met at university through whom I was ultimately converted. And the thing which he used to really speak to me, something I've never forgotten, he's still a very close friend of mine. The thing that God used through him to really speak to me was a Bible study he did one evening shortly after I met him on the book of Ecclesiastes. Because Ecclesiastes addresses this problem very directly. The problem of the futility of human life, if life is simply a life without God, life between birth and death, and the kind of human cynicism that results from that realization. And it had never occurred to me before that day that the Bible is actually speaking truth. I had always thought, like everybody else in our culture, that the Bible was simply a religious book, that it had nothing whatsoever to say about the real world, about reality, about our lives as they actually are. And it struck me with tremendous force when he started off reading Ecclesiastes chapter 1, because it was exactly where I was. Ecclesiastes is a book for today. It is a book for the cynic. And I've found many times when I have preached sermons or given evangelistic talks on the book of Ecclesiastes that God has really used that in people's lives. But let me suggest that as a way forward. No matter how despairing somebody is, they are still living in the world that God made. In my case, it was the glory of creation, which God used to touch my heart directly, without any human intermediary, and to bring to and to begin to call me towards himself. In this man's case in St. Louis, what he holds on to is his family, his marriage, as his haven from his cynicism. Your task, if you try to help someone, is to identify what their sacred corner is, what their little haven is, which they are keeping their cynicism out from, and try to help them to see that that is indeed a gift of God, and that their calling is to acknowledge the giver of that and every other good and perfect gift. So that's the first area, cynicism. The second is the area of relativism. Relativism means simply that truth and moral values are relative to the human person. We have to say, in fact, that if God does not exist, and if people do not believe in God, there is no other alternative except a truth which is simply relative to the human person. In other words, no truth at all. Moral values which are relative to the human person. In other words, no absolute moral values at all. And you remember I referred to the book by Robert Bellah on Thursday, B-E-L-L-A-H, Habits of the Heart, or he edited it rather than writing it, Habits of the Heart. And that is simply a study of ordinary Americans. And his study finds that that is where the vast majority of Americans are. They may not be familiar with the term relativist, but in fact they are. People live making their own choices about what they will believe and how they will live. They are the final authority for what is true and how they will live. They see there being no set of absolute standards, of certain standards outside themselves. It is one of the fundamental characteristics of our culture, this relativism. And you have to recognize that if you're going to try to communicate to people, because they simply don't hear a great deal of what you say. When you say what you believe as a Christian, when you say what Christianity says, how most unbelievers are hearing you is simply, this is what I think, these are my views, these are my values. Don't try and impose them on me. They don't hear you making a truth claim. They hear you simply telling them what your personal values are, what you've come to think, not what is true. And if you don't recognize that, it's going to be very difficult to communicate to anybody, because that's the automatic grid through which they interpret everything you say. I have my views, you have yours. You happen to be religious, I'm not. You go to church, I don't. You think abortion is wrong, I think it's fine. You think premarital sex is wrong, I think it's fine. That is what the unbeliever is hearing. These are your views. And he finds it offensive that you try to impose yours on him or her. Now, what does moral relativism really mean in practice? What does it really mean in practice to deny that God exists, to live in a world without God, where we think about moral values and law? We can say that if we are indeed living in a world without God, or for the person who is living in a world without God, there are really only four options, four possible ways in which moral choices are going to be made, or by which laws are going to be made. And what are they? They are this. First, simply the individual. The individual will say, I have a right to do what I choose to do. It's entirely up to me. Nobody else has a right to tell me what to do. That's fundamental to our culture. If you know anything about values clarification teaching in the schools, which has been found to be rather problematic, quite understandably, basically it is suggesting that the child has the means within themselves to clarify their own moral values, to come to their own choices, rather than the teacher should be imposing on the child or teaching to the child a set of absolute moral principles which exist outside them. The child has to find their values from within themselves. They have the means. That's the first option. And again, it shapes actually the way every one of us thinks who lives in this culture. We are all touched by it. Even though we may know that God's word is the truth, that God's commandments are certain and fixed, every one of us is touched by the notion that real freedom is found in simply making my own choices. And you constantly find people who have professed to be Christians running off with somebody's wife or husband or saying I'm suddenly homosexual or whatever it happens to be. And it's not just because they're struggling with that issue, because all of us struggle with different issues. A lot of it is because this is the society in which we live, which everybody is being brainwashed by. Everything you watch on television, everything you see in the movies, almost everything you read in your papers, not everything, of course, but the vast majority of it is telling you, you make your own choices. You are free, free to choose who you are going to be. The second option is simply that the majority will decide. William Golding, the English novelist, put it this way. He said, if God is dead, if man is the highest, good and evil will be decided by majority vote. If God is dead, if man is the highest, good and evil will be decided by majority vote. Consult the people. Ask what they think. Ask what they will vote for. And what the majority wants, that will be our law. That will tell us what is right. That will govern our society. I find that most Americans, including many Christians, actually think this is what democracy means and what it's always meant. Many Christians, I find, think that democracy is asking the people what they think is right and wrong. That's certainly not what democracy meant historically. Without any question, it has come to mean that more and more in this society. At the moment, as you know, the whole abortion issue is being thrown increasingly back to the states and to the elected representatives. The abortion issue is going to be decided on the basis of what the majority of the people think and who they will vote for, which is why you have many politicians who in the past have been pro-life suddenly retreating and saying, I'm pro-life, but I recognize that my constituency, these people have a choice. They're actually afraid of not being elected. It's one of the reasons why they're saying that and retreating very rapidly from the issue. Our mayor in St. Louis, who is going to be running for governor or hopes to run for governor, is doing that right now. He's a Roman Catholic. And having been staunchly pro-life for many, many years, suddenly he's come out. Now he's going to possibly be running for governor, and this question is going to hang as one of the fundamental issues in the election. He's just retreating. But that's how many Americans understand democracy. What the majority of the people think. That will tell us really what the laws should be for our society, how we will decide for our society what is going to be good and what is going to be evil. The consensus will rule. That's the second option, if we live in a world without God or if we don't believe in God. The third option is that might is right. Might is right. That is, those in power are going to tell us what we've got to do, whether we like it or not. And of course, that is what has ruled much of the world for much of its history. It's what rules much of the world right now. If you live in China right now, questions of abortion are not decided by consulting what is morally right or wrong, or what do the people think. The question is, what is going to be expedient for the state? What do those in power want? Maybe we have too many people. You can have one child. If you get pregnant again, abort it. Might is right. Those in power tell you what to do. Tiananmen Square is a horrible example of that. But the world is filled with examples of this. In Romania, you had a very different kind of example a few years ago when the state suddenly said, we don't have enough children. Abortion is too easy. We don't have enough labor force in our factories and on our farms. So everybody's got to stop practicing abortion. There's no attempt to ask what is right or wrong. It's simply, what does the state, what do those in power want? We want more workers. So you stop aborting your children, not because it's wrong, but because we need more people. Nevertheless, it didn't have a great deal of effect, I mean, understandably, in the circumstances. So thirdly, that's our third option, might is right. Those in power will decide. Now you might say, well, that has nothing to do with us living in a modern democracy. Well, it certainly does. Because in actual fact, how many of our laws are made in this society is by powerful lobby groups, powerful self-interest groups who seek to impose their will on the whole people. That's really how the Supreme Court has operated for the last two or three decades. A group of people on it who were convinced that they knew what was right for the American people, regardless of what the American people might think, and regardless of what God might say. That was their vision. We know what our society should be like. That is always the temptation of the liberal, who often despises the ordinary person and insists that they know for everybody what is right. A very dramatic example of this is Alfred Kinsey. Here's a person who had very strong views about human sexuality and about homosexuality. And as you've probably read, and I imagine Richard referred to in his workshop on homosexuality, Kinsey's report, published now over 40 years ago, was seriously flawed. His research was completely skewed in the direction of the results that he wanted. His figures were outrageously unreal in terms of his percentages of homosexuals in the society of people who'd had homosexual relationships and so on, and the same with people who'd been to prostitutes, etc. He used a group made up of college students and prisoners, neither of whom are generally representative of the whole population in terms of their sexual mores. He was absolutely committed in principle to sexual experimentation, to sexual permissiveness. But the figures that he published 45 years ago, whenever it was, have controlled the way many Americans have thought for a generation about these issues. And yet those figures were really false. Now he's an example of an individual or a small group of people who were powerfully committed to an idea and were able to bring that idea to bear on society as a whole with tremendous impact. Our society is full of groups like that, who might be the modern equivalent, we should say, of Plato's philosopher kings, the wise people who think they know what is right for everybody else. Now, we should note in passing here that as Christians we have to be careful. Because if we simply, as a tiny minority, try to impose our view on people without convincing them of what is right and true in the marketplace of ideas, we have just simply fallen into the same trap of being an elitist group who think we can tell everybody what they should do and know better than they do. And we do have to be very careful at that point. And that's certainly how many non-Christians perceive us again, that we are an elitist group simply trying to use the corridors of power to impose our will on the society. And what we should be doing, as well, yes, as political lobbying, is really getting out and convincing people of what is true and right, and changing the way they think
persuading them, recovering the power of persuasion on moral issues as well as other issues. So that's the third option. Might is right. Whether it's the power of a gun barrel or the power of an elite lobby group with its agenda. The fourth, and this is closely related, is that some ideology will decide the law for us, will be the basis for laws, for moral values in a society. And of course, the most obvious example is Marxism, which has governed such a large part of the world for much of the last 40 and some of it for the last 70 or more years, where there's a total rejection of any kind of absolute moral values, and all laws are basically subservient to the ideology of Marxism itself. Now, if we deny the existence of God, if we say man is alone in the universe, there are no other options, really, than these four. That is where we are left. The individual, the majority, some powerful individual or group, or some ideology which is going to come and give its arbitrary standards to the culture as a whole. Now, none of these, of course, give us any certain basis for moral values, any sure basis for law. And what this leads to, and what it has led to in our culture, is a tremendous uncertainty about moral values, about law. Our generation is kind of caught in the gap, on the one hand with a memory that one time law was fixed, that law was a given, that there was a rule of law in society which would never change, which detailed our obligations to one another and which came from God. That's the way almost the whole society felt at the founding of this country. And not only those who were believers, but those who were deists as well. And even rationalists believed that there was a firm moral order in the universe. So people are caught on the one hand between that and this view, which says moral values are completely in flux. They are up for grabs. And what I should be concerned about is not everybody else's needs and my obligation to them, but my own rights and what I can get out of life for myself. And not surprisingly, our society has become a litigious society, where our law courts are not concerned primarily for justice, but simply for allowing people to get what they can out of other people and out of the system, whether they're individuals or companies or whatever else. That's the reality in which we live. And many non-Christians, are deeply concerned about the moral confusion, the moral uncertainty in this society. Some of you have probably read Charles Colson's Against the Night. It's a helpful summary of some of the consequences of this moral uncertainty in our culture. And you've heard other people, I'm sure, talking about the new barbarism, the new dark ages. Well, they speak that way with real reason, living in this moment of history. And people worry about this. Many non-Christians worry about this. And the reason they do, of course, and can be thankful for that, is because, as Paul tells us in Romans 2, that God has inscribed his law on the heart of human beings. The law of God is written on the heart of every man and woman. And of course, one can harden one's own individual conscience so that one doesn't hear that law, and a culture as a whole can harden its conscience on any issue so that it becomes depraved in some particular area or other. But this does create a tremendous uncertainty for people. Now, what is our response to this? Our response will be to point out the moral confusion, to help people see what this really means, what your options are. And it will also be to point out the wonderful answer that the Bible gives us, that God himself is the foundation for the distinction between good and evil. That the character of God, the character of the holy and righteous God, defines for us with certainty the distinction between right and wrong. His character, we might say, is the moral foundation of the universe. As the scripture says, there is one lawgiver and judge. Only one. One lawgiver and judge, and that is God himself. And because God exists, and because he is a holy God, and because his character does provide the moral foundation for the universe in which we live, we do live in a moral universe. It really does matter how we live. It makes a difference whether I do good or evil, whether I'm kind or cruel, whether I show compassion to somebody or whether I'm brutal to them, whether I love my wife or I abuse her. It really makes a difference in the end because God exists. This holy God has made us in his image. He has made us to be like himself, to reflect his moral character, to be good like him, to be kind and compassionate and merciful like himself. He has made me not to please myself and to go my own way, but to walk in his ways, to model myself on his character. Now, what our culture obviously doesn't recognize when it says man or the individual man or woman can be their own basis for moral values, it doesn't recognize, of course, that people are sinners. Dorothy Sayers said, humanism always underestimates sin. It always underestimates sin, and our culture underestimates sin. People are sinful. And giving them a free rein to do what they want to do just leads one to all kinds of chaos. And this is true in each of these other areas. But God has made us in his image to be like him. And his law, his commandments, set out for us what it means to be like God, what it means to be the image of God. His commandments characterize for us who God is and who he has created us to be. You can think of the words of Leviticus 19, where Moses repeats over and over again, do this because I am the Lord. Because I, the Lord your God, am holy, you are to be holy. And then his commandments follow. His commandments set out what it means to be the image, the reflection of God. And consequently, to obey his commandments is fulfilling. To obey his commandments is fulfilling. We look around at our culture and we see people disobeying God's commandments everywhere, whether in marriage or in their sexual relationships or in their business or in whatever area it happens to be, and you see people destroying themselves. Certainly there are the pleasures of sin for a season. There are temporary pleasures from sin, whether it's sexual sin or any other kind of sin. But in the end, you reap a harvest of destruction. It's as simple as that. Why? Not because God's commandments are arbitrary, but because they really are a description of how we have been created to live and how we may find fulfillment in life. So if I disobey God's commandments, no matter how much pleasure I get at the moment, it always boomerangs on me. So if I become addicted to pornography, it may seem pleasurable for a while, but in the end it will boomerang on me. And it's the same with everything else. I become under the control of something else, which is less than I am. It diminishes my humanity. Sin starts being my master. I become in bondage to it. Now we can see the havoc of sin all over our culture at this present time, as people make their own choices and do whatever they want to do. You see the tremendous chaos that people reap. We do not live in a happy society. As people disobey God's commandments, we live in a very miserable society as people turn away from God. Let me read to you some powerful words of Jeremiah chapter 17. It was one of the poems I had printed out for the poet's seminar yesterday. And Jeremiah sets this out. Jeremiah 17:5-8. Cursed is the one who trusts in man, who depends on flesh for his strength, whose heart turns away from the Lord. He will be like a bush in the wastelands. He will not see prosperity when it comes. He will dwell in the parched places of the desert, in a salt land where no one lives. But blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, whose confidence is in him. He will be like a tree planted by the water that sends out its roots by the stream. It does not fear when heat comes. Its leaves are always green. It has no worries in a year of drought and never fails to bear fruit. As Psalm 1 and Psalm 19 speak in exactly the same way. But as we meditate on God's commandments and walk in his ways, so we find ourselves fulfilled. And as we turn away from them, so we destroy ourselves and become like the chaff that the wind blows away. And finally here, the scripture says that to walk in God's ways brings real freedom. If you really want to be free as an individual, you do what God says. Psalm 119 repeats it many times, but it says, "As I obey your commandments, Lord, I will walk about in freedom." And James says that in James 1, that God's law is a law of liberty, a perfect law, the law which gives freedom and blessing to the man who not only looks at it, but obeys it and perseveres in obeying it. God's law is a law which brings us true freedom. Our culture's pursuit of freedom is totally destructive. But God's word, God's commandments, offer us true freedom. I don't mean the kind of legalisms which pass in place of the law of God in so many of our churches and in so much of the teaching that goes around, all this authoritarian nonsense, and I mean that very seriously, which goes around all over the place, imposing rules on people which are certainly not there in Scripture and telling them that they are wisdom and that they will bring freedom. They will not, and many of you have experienced that, the bondage that they produce. Let me remind you of Paul's words in Colossians 2. He says, human rules, I don't care who they come from, human rules have an appearance of wisdom, but they lack any value in restraining the indulgence of the sinful nature. I can tell you, when I was at seminary, I had several fellow students who came from very legalistic backgrounds. So some of them at one point actually got up a petition to the faculty demanding that those of us who didn't conform to their rules, there were about four or five of us who came from totally non-Christian backgrounds, that our lifestyle should be forcibly changed by the administration and the faculty in terms of hair and everything else. You can imagine it was the late 60s. Now the faculty ignored it. But as I look at some of those students, with great sorrow I have to say that when I look at my fellow students from seminary who've committed adultery and who've ruined their ministry, they were the students who are most legalistic. Human rules have an appearance of wisdom, but they have absolutely no value in restraining the indulgence of the sinful nature. We do not know better than Scripture, and I don't care who says it to you. Not how many thousands of seminars they give, and how strong their teaching is. Go to the Word of God for the freedom that it offers, for the freedom of God's commandments, not somebody's rules imposed on your life. As we think about this and how are we going to reach out to people, we are able to offer to people the freedom that God's commandments give. The freedom of the rule of law, the gift of the rule of law, is one of the greatest gifts that Christians have been able to give to any society in history. Most societies have labored under the rule of men and the tyranny that men exert on one another. But wherever Christianity has had any kind of impact on any human society, and particularly in the countries touched by the Reformation, one of the gifts that Christians were able to give by the grace of God was the gift of law, that there is a law of God which governs human beings and which gives them freedom. As we live in an age of moral uncertainty, of moral chaos, of confusion, We are surrounded by people who feel uncertain. And we can help them to see where this moral chaos will lead them and what God offers in contrast in His Word. And Scripture does this itself over and over again. That's why you have Psalms like that in those passages in Jeremiah 17. They are a very powerful apologetic. I've had people coming to me in St. Louis. I remember one couple coming to me last year and saying, "We want to know about Christianity." And I said, "Why?" And they said, "Because we are about to have our first baby, and we don't have any idea how to raise this child to live in this society in its moral confusion." Now, there are many people like that who are hungry for some kind of moral certainty, as well as at the same time enjoying the pleasures of sin for a season. Nobody seeks God wholeheartedly. Nobody is following wholly after good. But people are confused, they are uncertain, and some of them are anxious to find something better. And we have something very much better to give. It was on this point that I was able to begin to communicate to my father. As I mentioned before, he was a Marxist. But the point where we began to communicate was his concern about the moral breakdown in this society, in our society in England, which is a few years ahead. Not that ahead is really the right word to use, because it makes it sound like progressiveness. That's not what I mean. You understand what I mean. Ahead in time. But he was so distressed by the moral breakdown of British society, because in many ways he was a very moral man. And the point where we will begin to communicate was right here. This is why these things are happening in our society. This is why there is this moral breakdown, as our generation is turned away from the Word of God and from the living God Himself, the lawgiver and judge. And it was through really that issue, that he became a Christian 6 weeks before he died of cancer at the age of 75, shortly after we returned to England. This is a very powerful point to touch people. Not teaching legalism to people, but teaching the liberty of the law of God over against the tyranny of the rule of man. Whether of the individual, the tyranny of the individual's passion, the tyranny of the majority, or the tyranny of those in power. I was so moved just recently hearing a pastor who had been in Moldavia, one of the republics of the Soviet Union. And the story he told me was amazing. Because you see there a situation where the rule of God, the rule of law, was totally taken away and replaced by Marxism and all its fruits. And this pastor, who was over there visiting some churches, was taken to visit the Minister of Culture in Moldavia, one of the Soviet republics. And this man said to him, and by the way, he used to be the man whose job was to persecute the church, among other things. And he said to him, and he wasn't a Christian, he said, "We know now that the heart of any culture is its religion. And our heart has been taken away from us. Our religion has been taken from us. We have looked into the face of the devil, and our consciences are seared." This is an unbeliever speaking, a communist official, an ex-communist official. "We have looked into the face of the devil, and our consciences are seared." And he says, "Now we have nothing with which to rebuild our society." And he said, "We look at the Orthodox Church, and it has nothing to give us. It's totally compromised with communism. Nobody respects it. We look at the evangelical church here, and they said they have nothing to give us because we have denied them education. They are totally pietistic. They have no idea that they have anything in Christianity to help us rebuild our society. Can you help us?" Saying, "Please come and help us." And what he was pleading for was the gift of law, the gift of the law of God as the basis for rebuilding that culture.
That brings me to the third issue, the issue of secularism. The issue of secularism. I'm going to have to go a little bit quicker here. I start
preaching at you and kind of abandon my notes and get carried away on some of these things. But
rightly so, I would say. I mean, these things are wonderful things we are talking about in terms of really what we have to give to people. But thirdly, secularism. By that I mean the insistence that I find my fulfillment entirely in the present. Here and now, life will give me what it has to give, and I must find what I can. Again, this is what our consumer society tells us every moment of every day. Every advert you watch on the television tells you exactly that. You have a right to be fulfilled now. You can get pleasure now. Now sink all your investments into personal fulfillment at this moment. Now what does this lead to? What does this lead to? What it leads to is people who spend their lives just pursuing pleasure, pursuing fulfillment of one kind and another. You will know that shopping has been characterized as a disease of this society. I'm serious. Some people have a disease of shopping. They are addicted shoppers. More and more extreme consumption. More and more bizarre consumption. Dorothy Sayers put it this way. She said, "Pleasure and pain will be kings in your cities." That's what's true in our society. Pleasure and pain are kings in our cities. Violence and drugs and sex, money and things and possessions, leisure. These are the things that people pursue, in which they try to find meaning. And they pursue them more and more frantically. As I look at our culture, it reminds me of the English poet John Keats. And this was one of the diseases, one might say, of the Romantic movement in literature and in the arts, because it was devoted to the human senses as the highest part of our humanity. And Keats was dying of tuberculosis. And one of the things he used to do, what he used to love, was to drink cold wine. Now, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but he wanted to heighten his senses and his enjoyment of cold wine. So he would pour pepper down his throat before he drank the wine. Now, you know, if you know anything about TB, about consumption, that's a terrible thing to do to yourself. But he would do it to increase his pleasure. And we're in a society like that, where there comes a very fine line between pleasure and pain. That's exactly what we see in drugs and in so many other aspects of the life of our culture. But these things, this pursuit of fulfillment in the here and now, is not enough to fill a human being's heart. It is not enough to fill a human being's heart. The book of Ecclesiastes puts it this way: God has set eternity in their hearts. That's true of every human individual, that God has set eternity in their hearts. And it is that reality of the fact that this pursuit of fulfillment here and now is not satisfying, it is that reality that opens so many people up to the New Age movement. Because they have eternity in their hearts. They are longing for something which is more than simply the here and now. They're longing for not just materialism, because they found that doesn't satisfy the human heart. They want some spiritual reality. They want something which goes beyond this life. They're yearning for immortality. They have a yearning for eternity, because God has set it there. They know that consumption does not bring peace to the human individual. more and more consumption. And so they long for an inner peace, which will give them a greater kind of hope. Now, as we think about that, it's precisely this materialism, this pursuit of present fulfillment, that leads people into the New Age movement. What's important for us as Christians is, again, that we don't raise a wall between ourselves and them. And I find most Christians want to write off New Age people. This is so dreadful what they're in. Let's keep away from them. Let's shun them. They might contaminate us. They might poison us. But don't write them off. Many of these people are still open. Many of them are still searching. Many of them are still longing for some reality of spirituality and are open to hearing. If you speak to them gently and with respect and graciously, that the road they're pursuing may appear like a gorgeous palace on the outside, but the devil sits at its heart and will destroy them. Many of them are still open to hearing that. And hearing that there is an alternative which does indeed offer eternity, which does indeed offer spirituality, which does indeed offer peace. And that alternative, of course, is the gospel itself. I have met several people who've been involved in aspects of the New Age movement, even who've been involved deeply in the occult, who have cried out in the middle of that, "God, if you're there, deliver me from this. I hate it. There must be something else." Now, of course, God is not obligated to hear the prayers of an unbeliever. Of course he's not. He has promised to hear the prayers of anyone who comes to him in the name of Christ. He's not obligated to hear the prayers of unbelievers, but God is very gracious, and he does hear them. In fact, it's very evident that such people God is drawing to himself. But God does hear such prayers, and I have met many people who have come out of that. We had a fellow who came to us at the English Labrie about 15 years ago now, who had been involved in deeply satanic things. And he cried out one day, "God, if you're there, if there is a God of goodness, get me out of this. I can't stand it." And the very next day, he met a Christian who brought him down to stay with us. And within less than a week, he became a Christian. Within just a couple of days, he said, "I want to know that there's somebody else there than this terrible thing I've been in." Now, so easily we write such people off and say they've had it. They can never be reached, and it is not true. God is able to reach everywhere and bring people out, even out of the very jaws of hell. You think of Manasseh in the Bible. He had offered his own children to pagan gods, to Moloch, and he became a believer at the end of his life. One can't imagine anything more dreadful than the things he did. And yet God delivered him. So don't ever write people off. One of our students at the seminary was a pastor of a church out in the country in rural Missouri. And there was a tremendous lot of occult in the local public high school. And the boy who was the ringleader of it was thrown out of the school because the school got so scared of what was going on and the effect it was having on the kids. And all the Christians in the town shunned him. Everybody shunned him. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with him. And this student of ours said, I decided after listening to you here about tearing down the walls, we had to reach out to this guy. And so we made an effort to get to know him, become friends with him, and now he's become a Christian. Very easily, actually. If anybody ever becomes a Christian easily, and of course they don't. But fairly quickly is really what I meant to say. And without a great deal of obvious pain. And was trying to bring all his other friends along, who he led into this stuff. You know, don't write people off. God is able to reach everywhere. And again, you know, such people, many of them, are longing for something deeper. The New Age will not give it to them, but we can indeed give it to them. Fourthly, I'll just say a couple of words here about idolatry, some of the idols of our time, the idols of work and sex and money and self and so on. Now, in a way, I've obviously spoken a bit about this already. There's a very powerful passage in Psalm 115, which I'd like to draw your attention to. And the psalm is speaking about the destructive nature of idolatry. Psalm 115, verses 1 through 8. And look at the contrast between God and the idols here. Not to us, O Lord, not to us, but to your name be the glory, because of your love and faithfulness. Why do the nations say, "Where is our God?" Our God is in heaven. He does whatever pleases him. But their idols are silver and gold, made by the hands of men. They have mouths, but they cannot speak, eyes, but they cannot see, ears, but they cannot hear, noses, but they cannot smell, hands, but they cannot feel, feet, they cannot walk, nor can they utter a sound with their throats. Those who make them will be like them, and so will all who trust in them. Whatever idol you worship, in the end will destroy you. It'll give you pleasure for a while, whether it's work or sex or money or anything else, but in the end it will disappoint you. This friend of mine in St. Louis I've spoken about a lot. He's a very wealthy man, but he's one of the most miserable people I have ever met. Success in his work, money, has been his idol. But they have brought him increasing disappointment and not any kind of enduring fulfillment. I'd encourage you to read the whole of Isaiah 40 through 48. Because in that section, in those chapters, Isaiah chapter 40 through 48, Isaiah is constantly comparing idolatry and its effect on people and the way God is able to deliver. Now, as we think about how to talk to people who are caught with some idolatry other, whether it's work or whatever it happens to be, I would say we can challenge them directly. Just a couple of weeks ago, I preached a message on work to a group mostly of non-Christians in St. Louis. Many of them were unbelievers, talking about the idolatry of work. And it had a tremendous impact on some of those people. And there's several of them now really excited about trying to find out what Christianity is really all about and beginning to ask questions and searching. And we can address these things very directly. This again is where this division between the sacred and the secular is so destructive, because it means we have nothing really powerful to say about the very things which people are struggling with in our culture. I preached on work this morning, and one of the men came up to me afterwards, and he almost echoed my own words of the other night when I said I hadn't heard a sermon on work since I'd been here in the United States in 2.5 years. And what he said, though, was, "I've been a Christian for 22 years and I haven't heard a sermon on work." Not ever. Well, let me say, to talk about sex. See, we can address these things directly. Let me finish just with an illustration here. This was several years ago now. A Christian group at one of the colleges in England invited me to give a talk on sex. And they had advertised it simply, "Sex." In the junior common room at 7:30 Wednesday evening. And you can imagine there were lots of people there. You know, sex is a very interesting subject to college students. And again, most of this group were non-believers. And I just spoke really for 15 or 20 minutes on the difference between what our society says about sex and permissiveness and personal freedom, and what God's commandments have to say about sex and about chastity and faithfulness. And I felt a little bit like I was in a lion's den. Well, I was. The first 15 minutes or so of the discussion were taken up by a few fellows at the back who'd just come out of the bar and were half drunk, and who were really outraged with what I was saying. But everybody managed to quieten them down. I didn't have to. The rest of the people did. And then we had a wonderful discussion for over 2 hours. And one after another, many of these non-Christians towards the end started standing up and saying, it is so wonderful to hear that there is a reason to be chaste and to be faithful. And we get so fed up with this pressure to conform. Now, we can address people's idols directly. They will not fulfill them. They will give them no final fulfillment. But we have a God who will meet every need of the human heart and who is himself our fulfillment. He is our portion, as the Old Testament says. We belong to him and he belongs to us. And he is the one who gives us fulfillment both now and eternally. I'm going to have to stop there. I've already gone on longer than I intended to. We've got time, I think, for a few questions here. Go ahead.
A lot of people I'm around are really into relativism and pretty much buying into that. And I appreciate the workshop that they gave this for. It's very informative. I find myself, when I'm dealing with them, a lot of times saying myself things like, well, I believe. Expressing one of God's truths. And that almost seems to affirm their view.
Right.
And yet, as you pointed out, if I were to confront them with the statement as if it were true, absolute truth, it would be offensive to them. I'm just wondering, maybe some of your thoughts about how do we handle that point of contact out of respect for them and their views.
Yeah, what I would say is this, and it's a good question. Just saying I believe to somebody won't get you very far. I mean, it really won't. Because you're just kind of swapping things. In terms of the way they think it. I think this, you think that. Okay, fine. I think what you always try to do is show somebody first where their own view will lead them. What moral relativism really means in practice. Are they prepared to live with it? In fact, you will find that nobody is. Every individual you ever talk to will have some areas in their own life where they insist on making certain moral judgments of other people. You know, they will talk about themselves, yeah, I have to be free to make my choices. But when it actually comes down to it, as you get to know them and as you get to talk to them, you will find that there are points where they'll say, that's really wrong. You know, Nixon was wrong to do that. Or Carter was wrong to do that, whatever political side they're coming from. Or maybe Kennedy was wrong to do that. So whoever they are, they're going to be points where they're going to insist on speaking as if certain things really had a solid moral value. And you need to help them to see that. To help them to understand what a real consistency to a relativistic position would mean. Again, to ride their tiger. Remember, I used Schaefer's expression earlier. That's the first thing, I would say, to start in that direction. Because Schaefer used to use the image, and it's a very helpful one, that what you're trying to do is, what every unbeliever does, is build a little roof over his or her head. And the roof protects them from the rain and the snow which is coming down here and the storms. That's its purpose. And it protects them from actually having to face reality. So the cynic may claim, I'm a cynic, but he has a little roof which protects his family or some other area of his life. The moral relativist may say, I have no certain moral values, it's entirely up to the individual, but he has a little roof which are the areas where he makes moral judgments, which he's absolutely convinced about. And you find this in any context. If you go into a prison, for example, you will find that prisoners of any kind have a very powerful sense that, okay, what they did was fine, and they really feel resentful that they've been punished for it, but what these guys did over here, that was really terrible. And they may even kill them. Because they all have a sense that there are indeed things which are ultimately right or ultimately wrong.
And they do because that is inscribed on their hearts by God. That's exactly what Paul means. You know, when he says that in Romans 1, Schaefer used to use the marvelous image, which I shared with some of you last night, when he was talking about Romans 1 and how Paul talks about the unbeliever who judges other people and then does the same things himself, who has the law of God written on his heart and yet constantly excuses his own behavior, and sometimes commends people who are doing wrong things and other times judges them. And Schaefer used to use this image. He said, imagine you had a tape recorder put around your neck and it recorded every moral judgment you ever made of another human individual, either verbally or just in your mind. Just imagine that. I mean, just think of the list of things that would be on that tape recorder. It'd be pretty terrible, wouldn't it? All God would have to do, he said, on the day of judgment would be to press the playback button. You'd be condemned out of your own mouth. Now, really, in a way, that's what you're trying to do with the moral relativist. You're trying to find in his life those areas where he still insists on saying there really is a difference between good and evil. Child abuse really is wrong. It's not just simply a matter of choice. And every individual has things like that, where they say, where they, if you like, keep their sacred corner within moral relativism or build their roof over their heads. Now what Schaefer says you've got to try to do is remove the roof so the rain starts falling on the individual. Yeah. Not because you want to hurt somebody, but because you're trying to show them what this really means to have this view. Where this idol, if you like to call it that, and it is an idol in a way, where this idol will ultimately lead them, how it will destroy them, and it will take away the value of their own life and of anything which is really precious to them. That is what you're going to have to try to do. At the same time, you try to say, now there really is a roof over here, which is a good deal bigger, and is absolutely solid, and is eternal. And that's the one that God is responsible for, the ultimate lawgiver and judge. And he is the one who enables us to say, yeah, that really is wrong. Now again, as I said, that was the way I began to communicate to my dad. You know, because in some areas he was a very moral individual. And he was very appalled by what was happening in our culture. And he wanted to know, why is it happening? So that's where we began to talk. The things that were on his heart. Again, to use that image from Romans 1 of holding down the truth and unrighteousness, the areas in his heart where the truth slips through, and he holds on to it and says, yeah, that's really wrong. Yeah. So rather than saying, this is what I think, this is what I believe, just start dealing with what he believes, with what he thinks, and where it will lead him if he's consistent to it. You know, take the roof off. And then show him what the truth is. As a contrast. But this is the only thing, not because I believe it, but because this is the truth about reality, because God exists. That will give us a solid basis for being able to make these judgments.
If we live in a society of people who are leading the nation, who are mostly unchristian and not under the law of the Bible, how do we go about trying to mandate those laws that we want to be put in that go along with our Christian law? And, you know, it's sort of the same question except on a bigger scale. You know, how do you go about revealing to them, even on a local level or state level or national level, the need to incorporate these Christian values into law?
There isn't any simple answer to that. In the end, shouting at people and telling them what we think won't do it. What will do it is persuading them of what is right and true. We have to get involved in the persuasion of people. Let me give you an illustration. The school my boys go to, one of their teachers asked them, how many of you are pro-life and how many of you are pro-choice? There were only two boys in the class who were pro-life. My son and another boy who is a Korean boy who's also a member of a PCA church, a Korean Presbyterian church in St. Louis. Everybody else in the class was pro-choice. Now, why? That's because we as Christians, even though there are quite a lot of us, have not begun to get into the marketplace of ideas to try to actually communicate to people what we think and why we think human life in the womb is human life and is precious to God and should be precious to us. We haven't really begun to work at that level. The areas in which we worked, some of them have been very good, but at that level we haven't. And a lot of that is because of these walls that I've been talking about. We don't even try to communicate it. We sometimes lob a rock over the wall, say this is what we think, and we shout it very loudly. But in terms of actually getting involved and really trying to teach people, we haven't begun. And we won't win on that issue or any other moral issue until we get involved in that work of education, of teaching, of persuasion. Now, let me tell you about Wilberforce 100 years ago, 150 years ago. When he set out as a young believer to try to abolish slavery and the slave trade in England, he realized that there were two things he had to do at the same time. One was to work with all his effort to abolish slavery. The other was to work with all his effort at the moral re-education of the English nation. Because he knew he was up against such powerful forces. The slave trade was immensely profitable for Britain as a colonial power. It was immensely profitable for many businesses, and for many people, money always speaks louder than moral values. And he and his friends committed themselves to praying for and starting to teach in every way they possibly could people about the value of black people and the wickedness of slavery before God and of the slave trade. And it took 44 years. It wasn't until he was almost dying that those laws were finally totally changed. And by that time, despite the fact that it carried on being so profitable, they were able to pass laws in Parliament because the conscience of the nation had changed because of the commitment of Christians to really teach people. Of course, in the process, many people became Christians because as soon as you start touching any moral issue, you're immediately talking about where those moral values come from. They come from God Himself. But we have to get involved in persuasion. Now, as I said, it's not enough just to try and become a powerful political lobby group, which is lobbying against some other group, the pro-choice group or the gay rights group or whatever other group it happens to be, or the pro-pornography group or whatever it is. We've got to work in that area, okay, but by itself it won't do. It won't do. You know, we have to work at getting involved in communicating with people and with our neighbors on the individual level, in the schools wherever we can, in our colleges, in whatever way. One of the things my son did, I didn't tell him to do it, was he wrote an article for his school student newspaper on abortion, just setting out very carefully his views and why he feels that human babies in the womb are human and why abortion is wrong. There are all kinds of contexts in which we can start communicating to people. But we have to do it wisely. We have to do it prayerfully. And we have to do it in a way which respects people and our opponents sufficiently, for they will read it. If we just speak stridently, people no longer hear us. And, you know, I was telling some of you last night about the organization CARE in England, which is the primary evangelical pro-life group. And they really changed their approach. 15 years ago, the approach of the group that preceded them was primarily marches, protests, proclamations of the law of God. And they were perceived primarily as being a judgmental organization. Strident Christians shouting at everybody else. And they changed their calling because they thought it was right before God. They changed their name to CARE, but they began to commit themselves to educating people, to educating members of parliament, to really doing deep research, to really caring for unmarried mothers, starting an AIDS hospice, doing all kinds of really constructive things to actually help people, and especially doing lots of education. Now, they haven't won their battle, but I would say they've advanced a considerable distance since they began their work 10 or 12 years ago, whenever it was that CARE was formed. And that has to be the direction in which we go. You know, we have to change the way people think. And for many of them, that will mean becoming Christians, because they won't change the way they think until they do. But it means communicating God's truth in every way that we can.